The oldest Grasden stirred in his seat, and his pearls clacked together softly.
"A dragon of our choice," he said in a thin, hard voice. "The black one is largest and healthiest."
"His name is Drogon," she nodded.
"All your goods, save your crown and your queenly raiment, which we will allow you to keep. The three ships and Drogon."
"Done," she said, in the common tongue.
"Done,"
the old Grasden answered in his thick Valyrian. The others echoed that old man of the pearl fringe.
"Done," the slave girl translated. And done, 8 times done."
"The Unsullied will learn your savage tongue quick enough," added Krasny's Monaclus, when all the arrangements had been made. "But until such time, you will need a slave to speak to them. Take this one, as our gift to you, a token of a bargain well struck."
"I shall," said Danny. The slave girl rendered his words to her, and hers to him. If she had feelings about being given for a token, she took care not to let them show. Aston Whitebeard held his tongue as well when Danny swept by him on the terrace. He followed her down the steps in silence, but she could hear his hardwood staff tap-tapping on the red bricks as they went. She did not blame him for his fury. It was a wretched thing she did. The mother of dragons has sold her strongest child. Even the thought made her ill. Yet down in the Plaza of Pride, standing on the hot red bricks between the slaver's pyramid and the barracks of the eunuchs, Danny turned on the old man. "Whitebeard," she said, "I want your counsel, and you should never fear to speak your mind with me, when we are alone, but never question me in front of strangers. Is that understood?"
"Yes, your grace," he said unhappily.
"I am not a child," she told him, "I am a queen."
"Yet even queens can err. The Astabori have cheated you, your grace. A dragon is worth more than any army. Aegon proved that 300 years ago, upon the field of fire."
"I know what Aegon proved. I mean to prove a few things of my own." Danny turned away from him to the slave girl standing meekly beside her litter. "Do you have a name, or must you draw a new one every day from some barrel?"
"That is only for Unsullied," the girl said,
and she realized the question had been asked in High Valyrian. Her eyes went wide.
"Oh,
your name is O?"
"No, your grace, forgive this one her outburst. Your slave's name is Masandi, but—"
"Masandi is no longer a slave. I free you from this instant. Come ride with me in the litter. I wish to talk." Ricardo helped them in, and Danny drew the curtains shut against the dust and heat. "If you stay with me, you will serve as one of my handmaids," she said, as they set off. "I shall keep you by my side to speak for me as you spoke for Krasny's. But you may leave my service whenever you choose, if you have a father or a mother you would sooner return to."
This one will stay," the girl said. "This one, there is no place for me to go. This I will serve you gladly."
"I can give you freedom, but not safety," Danny warned. "I have a world to cross, and wars to fight. You may go hungry. You may grow sick. You may be killed."
Vela Morgulas," said Missandei in High Valyrian.
"All men must die," Danny agreed, "but not for a long while, we may pray." She leaned back on the pillows and took the girl's hand. "Are these Unsullied truly fearless?"
"Yes, your grace."
"You serve me now. Is it true they feel no pain?"
"The wine of courage kills such feelings. By the time they say their sucklings, they have been drinking it for years."
"And they are obedient?"
"Obedience is all they know. If you tell them not to breathe, they would find that easier than not to obey."
Danny nodded. "And when I am done with them?"
"Your grace?"
"When I have won my war and claimed the throne that was my father's, my knights will sheathe their swords and return to their keeps, to their wives and children and mothers, to their lives. But these eunuchs have no lives. What am I to do with 8,000 eunuchs when there are no more battles to be fought?"
"The Unsullied make fine gods, and Erkland, a watchman. Your Grace, said Missandei, and it is never hard to find a buyer for such fine, well-blooded troops.
Men are not bought and sold in Westeros, they tell me.
With all respect, Your Grace, unsullied are not men.
If I did resell them, how would I know they could not be used against me? Danny asked pointedly. Would they do that? Fight against me? Even do me harm?
If their master commanded, they do not question, Your Grace. All the questions have been culled from them. They obey.
She looked troubled.
When you are done with them, Your Grace might command them to fall upon their swords.
And even that they would do.
Yes.
Missandei's voice had grown soft.
Your Grace.
Danny squeezed her hand. You would sooner he did not ask it of them, though. Why is that? Why do you care?
Oh, that swan does not... Your Grace.
Tell me. The girl lowered her eyes.
Three of them were my brothers once, Your Grace.
Then I hope your brothers are as brave and clever as you. Danny leaned back into her pillow and let the litter bear her onward back to Valerian one last time to set her world in order. And back to Drogon. Her mouth set grimly. It was a long, dark, windy night that followed. Danny fed her dragons, as she always did, but found she had no appetite herself. She cried a while, alone in her cabin, then dried her tears long enough for yet another argument with Grolio. Magister Illyrio is not here, she finally had to tell him, and if he was, he could not sway me either. I need the Unsullied more than I need these ships, and I will hear no more about it. The anger burned the grief and fear from her for a few hours at the least. Afterward she called her blood riders to her cabin with Ser Jorah. They were the only ones she truly trusted. She meant to sleep afterward, to be well rested for the morrow, but an hour of restless tossing in the stuffy confines of the cabin soon convinced her that that was hopeless. Outside her door she found Aegor fitting a new string to his bow by the light of a swinging oil lamp. Rakaro sat cross-legged on the deck beside him, sharpening his arrack with a whetstone. Danny told them both to keep on with what they were doing, and went up on deck for a taste of the cool night air. The crew left her alone as they went about their business, but Ser Jorah soon joined her by the rail. He is never far, Danny thought. He knows my moods too well.
Khaleesi, you ought to be asleep. Tomorrow will be hot and hard, I promise you. You'll need your strength.
Do you remember Aroa? She asked him.
The Lazarine girl?
They were raping her, but I stopped them and took her under my protection. Only when my son and Stars was dead, Mago took her back, used her again, and killed her. Aegor said it was her fate.
I remember, Ser Jorah said.
I was alone for a long time, Jorah. All alone, but for my brother. I was such a small, scared thing. Viserys should have protected me, but instead he hurt me and scared me worse. He shouldn't have done that. He wasn't just my brother, he was my king. Why do the guards make kings and queens if not to protect the ones who can't protect themselves?
Some kings make themselves. Robert did.
He was no true king, Danny said scornfully. He did no justice. Justice. That's what kings are for. Ser Jorah had no answer. He only smiled and touched her hair. So lightly. It was enough. That night she dreamt that she was Rhaegar, riding to the Trident. But she was mounted on a dragon, not a horse. When she saw the usurper's rebel host across the river, they were armored all in ice. But she bathed them in dragon fire, and they melted away like dew and turned the Trident into a torrent. Some small part of her knew that she was dreaming, but another part exulted. This is how it was meant to be. The other was a nightmare, and I've only now awakened. She woke suddenly in the darkness of her cabin, still flushed with triumph. Valerian seemed to wake with her, and she heard the faint creak of wood, water lapping against the hull, a footfall on the deck above her head, and something else. Someone was in the cabin with her. "Erie? Shiqui? Where are you?" Her handmaids did not respond. It was too black to see, but she could hear them breathing. "Jara, is that you?"
"Nice sleep," a woman said. "May you sleep?"
The voice was very close.
"Even dragons must sleep."
"She is standing over me. Who is there?" Danny peered into the darkness. She thought she could see a shadow, the faintest outline of a shape. "What do you want of me?"
"Remember, to go north, you must journey south. To reach the west, you must go east. To go forward, you must go back. And to touch the light, you must pass beneath the shadow."
"Quaithe?" Danny sprung from her bed and threw open the door. Pale yellow lantern light flooded the cabin, and Erie and Jiqui sat up sleepily.
"Khaleesi?"
murmured Jiqui, rubbing her eyes. The Syrian woke and opened his jaws, and a puff of flame brightened even the darkest corners. There was no sign of a woman in a red lacquer mask.
"Khaleesi, are you unwell?" asked Jiqui.
"A dream." Danny shook her head. "I dreamed a dream, no more. Go back to sleep. All of us, go back to sleep." Yet try as she might, sleep would not come again. "If I look back, I am lost," Danny told herself the next morning as she entered Astapor through the harbor gates. She dared not remind herself how small and insignificant her following truly was, or she would lose all courage. Today she rode her silver, clad in horsehair pants and painted leather vest, a bronze medallion belt about her waist and two more crossed between her breasts. Erie and Jiqui had braided her hair and hung it with a tiny silver bell, whose chime sang of the undying of Karth, burned in their palace of dust. The red brick streets of Astapor were almost crowded this morning. Slaves and servants lined the ways, while the slavers and their women donned their tokars to look down from their stepped pyramids. "They are not so different from Carthene, after all," she thought. "They want a glimpse of dragons to tell their children of, and their children's children." It made her wonder how many of them would ever have children. Aego went before her with his great Dothraki bow. Strong Belwas walked to the right of her mare, the girl Missandei to her left. Sir Jorah Mormont was behind, in mail and surcoat, glowering at anyone who came too near. Ricardo and Jogo protected the litter. Danny had commanded that the top be removed so her three dragons might be chained to the platform. Erie and Jiqui rode with them to try and keep them calm. Yet Viserion's tail lashed back and forth, and smoke rose angry from his nostrils. Rhaegal could sense something wrong as well. Thrice he tried to take wing, only to be pulled down by the heavy chain in Jiqui's hand. Drogon coiled into a ball, wings and tail tucked tight. Only his eyes remained to tell that he was not asleep. The rest of her people followed. Grolio and the other captains and their crews, and the 83 Dothraki who remained to her of the 100,000 who had once ridden in Drogo's Khalasar. She put the oldest and weakest on the inside of the column, with the nursing women and those with child, and the little girls and the boys too young to braid their hair. The rest, her warriors, such as they were, rode outside and moved their dismal herd along, the 100-odd gaunt horses that had survived both Red Waste and Black Salt Sea. "I ought to have a banner sewn," she thought, as she led her tattered band up along Astapor's meandering river. She closed her eyes to imagine how it would look, all flowing black silk, and on it the red three-headed dragon of Targaryen, breathing golden flames. A banner such as Rhaegar might have borne. The river's banks were strangely tranquil. The Worm, the Astapori call the stream. It was wide and slow and crooked, dotted with tiny wooded islands. she glimpsed children playing on one of them, darting amongst elegant marble statues. On another island, two lovers kissed in the shade of tall green trees with no more shame than Dothraki at a wedding. Without clothing, she could not tell if they were slave or free. The Plaza of Pride, with its great bronze harpy, was too small to hold all the Unsullied she had bought. Instead, they had been assembled in the Plaza of Punishment, fronting on Astapor's main gate, so they might be marched directly from the city once Daenerys had taken them in hand. There were no bronze statues here, only a wooden platform where rebellious slaves were racked and flayed and hanged.
But the good masters placed them so they will be the first thing a new slave sees upon entering the city,
Missandei told her as they came to the plaza. At first glimpse, Danny thought their skin was striped, like the zorsis of Jogos Nahi. Then she rode her silver nearer, and saw the raw red flesh beneath the crawling black stripes.
Flies and maggots.
The rebellious slaves had been peeled, like a man might peel an apple, in a long, curling strip. One man had an arm black with flies from fingers to elbow, and red and white beneath. Danny reined in beneath him. What did this one do?
He raised a hand against his honor.
Her stomach roiling, Danny wheeled her silver about and trotted toward the center of the plaza and the army she had bought so dear. Rank on rank on rank they stood, her stone halfmen with their hearts of brick, 8,600 in the spiked bronze caps of fully trained Unsullied, and 5,000-odd behind them, bareheaded, yet armed with spears and short swords. The ones farthest to the back were only boys, she saw, but they stood as straight and still as all the rest. Krasnys Monaklos and his fellows were all there to greet her. Other well-born Astapori stood in knots behind them, sipping wine from silver flutes, as slaves circulated among them with trays of olives and cherries and figs. The elder Grazdan sat in a sedan chair supported by four huge copper-skinned slaves. Half a dozen mounted lancers rode along the edges of the plaza, keeping back the crowds who had come to watch. The sun flashed blinding bright off the polished copper discs sewn to their cloaks, but she could not help but notice how nervous their horses seemed. They fear the dragons, and well they might. Krasnys had a slave help her from her saddle. His own hands were full, one clutched his tokar, while the other held an ornate whip.
"Here they are," he looked at Missandei. "Tell her they are hers, if she can pay."
"She can," the girl said.
So Jorah barked a command, and the trade goods were brought forward. 6 bales of tiger skins, 300 bolts of fine silk, jars of saffron, jars of myrrh, jars of pepper and curry and cardamom, an onyx mask, 12 jade monkeys, casks of ink in red and black and green, a box of rare black amethysts, a box of pearls, a cask of pitted olives stuffed with maggots, 12 casks of pickled cavefish, 1 great brass gong, and a hammer to beat it with, 17 ivory eyes, and a huge chest full of books written in tongues that Danny could not read, and more, and more, and more. Her people stacked it all before the slavers. While the payment was being made, Krasnys Monaklos favored her with a few final words on the handling of her troops.
"They are green as yet," he said through Missandei. "Tell the whore of Westeros she would be wise to blood them early. There are many small cities between here and there, cities ripe for sacking. Whatever plunder she takes will be hers alone. Unsullied have no lust for gold or gems, and should she take captives, a few guards will suffice to march them back to Astapor. We'll buy the healthy ones for a good price, and who knows, in 10 years some of the boys she sends us may be Unsullied in their turn. Thus all shall prosper."
Finally, there were no more trade goods to add to the pile. Her Dothraki mounted their horses once more, and Danny said, "This was all we could carry. The rest awaits you on the ships, a great quantity of amber and wine and black rice. And you have the ships themselves, so all that remains is the dragon," finished the Grasdan with a spiked beard, who spoke the common tongue so thickly. "And here he waits." Sir Jorah and Belwas walked beside her to the litter, where Drogon and his brothers lay basking in the sun. Jiqui unfastened one end of the chain and handed it down to her. When she gave a yank, the black dragon raised its head, hissing, and unfolded wings of night and scarlet. Krasny's monocular smiled broadly as their shadow fell across him. Danny handed the slaver the end of Drogon's chain. In return, he presented her with a whip. The handle was black dragon bone, elaborately carved and inlaid with gold. 9 long thin leather lashes trailed from it, each one tipped by a gilded claw. The gold pommel was a woman's head, with pointed ivory teeth.
"The harpy's fingers," Grasny's named the scourge.
Danny turned the whip in her hand. "Such a light thing, to bear such weight." "Is it done, then? Do they belong to me?"
"It is done,"
he agreed, giving the chain a sharp pull to bring Drogon down from the litter. Danny mounted her silver. She could feel her heart thumping in her chest. She felt desperately afraid. Was this what my brother would have done? She wondered if Prince Rhaegar had been this anxious when he saw the usurper's host formed up across the Trident with all their banners floating in the wind. She stood in her stirrups and raised the harpy's fingers above her head for all the unsullied to see. "It is done," she cried at the top of her lungs. "You are mine." She gave the mare her heels and galloped along the first rank, holding the fingers high. "You are the dragons now. You're bought and paid for. It is done. It is done." She glimpsed old Grasdan, turned his grey head sharply. "He hears me speak Valyrian." The other slavers were not listening. They crowded around Krasny's and the dragon, shouting advice. Though the Astapori yanked and tugged, Drogon would not budge off the litter. Smoke rose grey from his open jaws, and his long neck curled and straightened as he snapped at the slaver's face. "It is time to cross the Trident," Danny thought, as she wheeled and rode her silver back. Her blood riders moved in close around her. "You are in difficulty," she observed.
"He will not come,"
Krasny said. "There is a reason. A dragon is no slave." And Danny swept the lash down as hard as she could across the slaver's face. Krasny screamed and staggered back, the blood running red down his cheek into his perfumed beard. The harpy's fingers had torn his features half to pieces with one slash, but she did not pause to contemplate the ruin. "Drogon!" she sang out loudly, sweetly, all her fear forgotten. "Dracarys!" The black dragon spread his wings and roared. A lance of swirling dark flame took Krasny's full in the face. His eyes melted and ran down his cheeks, and the oil in his hair and beard burst so fiercely into fire that for an instant the slaver wore a burning crown twice as tall as his head. The sudden stench of charred meat overwhelmed even his perfume, and his wail seemed to drown all other sound. Then the plaza of punishment blew apart into blood and chaos. The good masters were shrieking, stumbling, shoving one another aside, and tripping over the fringes of their tokars in their haste. Drogon flew almost lazily at Krasny's, black wings beating. As he gave the slaver another taste of fire, Irion Jiqui unchained Viserion and Rhaegal, and suddenly there were 3 dragons in the air. When Danny turned to look, a third of Astapor's proud, demon-horned warriors were fighting to stay atop their terrified mounts, and another third were fleeing in a bright blaze of shiny copper. One man kept his saddle long enough to draw a sword, but Jogo's whip coiled around his neck and cut off his shout. Another lost a hand to Ricaro's Arak and rode off reeling and spurting blood. Aego sat calmly notching arrows to his bowstring and sending them at tokars. Silver, gold, or plain, he cared nothing for the fringe. Strong Belwas had his arrack out as well, and he spun it as he charged.
"Spears!"
Danny heard one Astapori shout. It was Grasdan, old Grasdan, in his tow-car, heavy with pearls.
"On solid! Defend us! Stop them! Defend your masters! Spears! Swords!"
When Ricardo put an arrow through his mouth, the slaves holding a sedan chair broke and ran, dumping him unceremoniously on the ground. The old man crawled to the first rank of eunuchs, his blood pooling on the bricks. The Unsullied did not so much as look down to watch him die. Rank on rank on rank, they stood, and did not move. The guards have heard my prayer.
"Unsullied!"
Danny galloped before them, her silver-gold braid flying behind her, her bell chiming with every stride.
"Slay the good masters! Slay the soldiers! Slay every man who wears a toka or holds a whip, but harm no child under 12, and strike the chains of every slave you see!"
She raised the harpy's fingers in the air, and then she flung the scourge aside.
"Freedom!" she sang out. "Dracarys! Dracarys!
Dracarys!"
they shouted back, the sweetest word she'd ever heard.
"Dracarys! Dracarys!"
And all around them, slavers ran and sobbed and begged and died, and the dusty air was filled with spears and fire. Sansa. On the morning her new gown was to be ready, the serving girls filled Sansa's tub with steaming hot water and scrubbed her head to toe until she glowed pink. Cersei's own bedmaid trimmed her nails and brushed and curled her auburn hair so it fell down her back in soft ringlets. She brought a dozen of the queen's favorite scents as well. Sansa chose a sharp, sweet fragrance with a hint of lemon in it under the smell of flowers. The maid dabbed some on her finger and touched Sansa behind each ear and under her chin and then lightly on her nipples. Cersei herself arrived with the seamstress, and watched as they dressed Sansa in her new clothes. The small clothes were all silk, but the gown itself was ivory samite and cloth of silver, and lined with silvery satin. The points of the long dagged sleeves almost touched the ground when she lowered her arms, and it was a woman's gown, not a little girl's, there was no doubt of that. The bodice was slashed in front almost to her belly, the deep V covered over with a panel of ornate, Moorish lace in dove grey. The skirts were long and full, the waist so tight that Sansa had to hold her breath as they laced her into it. They brought her new shoes as well, slippers of soft grey doeskin that hugged her feet like lovers.
"You are very beautiful, my lady," the seamstress said when she was dressed.
"I am, aren't I?" Sansa giggled and spun, her skirts swirling around her. "Oh, I am!" She could not wait for Willis to see her like this.
"He will love me. He will. He must. He will forget Winterfell when he sees me. I'll see that he does."
Queen Cersei studied her critically. "A few gems, I think. The moonstones Joffrey gave her."
"At once, your grace,"
her maid replied. When the moonstones hung from Sansa's ears and about her neck, the queen nodded. "Yes, the guards have been kind to you, Sansa. You are a lovely girl. It seemed almost obscene to squander such sweet innocence on that gargoyle."
"What gargoyle?"
Sansa did not understand. Did she mean Willis?
How could she know?
No one knew, but her and Margaery and the Queen of Thorns. Oh, and Dantos, but he didn't count. Cersei Lannister ignored the question. "The cloak," she commanded, and the women brought it out. A long cloak of white velvet, heavy with pearls. A fierce direwolf was embroidered upon it in silver thread. Sansa looked at it with sudden dread. "Your father's colors," said Cersei, as they fastened about her neck with a slender silver chain. "A maiden's cloak." Sansa's hand went to her throat. She would have torn the thing away if she had dared. "You're prettier with your mouth closed, Sansa," Cersei told her. "Come along now, the Septon is waiting, and the wedding guests as well." "No," Sansa blurted, "no!" Yes, you are a ward of the crown. The king stands in your father's place. Since your brother is an attainted traitor, that means he has every right to dispose of your hand. You are to marry my brother, Tyrion. My claim, she thought, sickened. Dontus the Fool was not so foolish after all. He had seen the truth of it. Sansa backed away from the queen. I won't. I'm to marry Willis. I'm to be the Lady of Highgarden. Please. I understand your reluctance. Cry if you must. In your place, I would likely rip my hair out. He's a loathsome little imp, no doubt of it. But marry him you shall. You can't make me. Of course we can. You may come along quietly and say your vows as befits a lady, or you may struggle and scream and make a spectacle for the stable boys to titter over. But you will end up wedded and bedded all the same. The queen opened the door. Sir Meron Trant and Sir Osmond Kettleblack were waiting without, in the white-scale armour of the king's guard. "Escort Lady Sansa to the sept," she told them. "Carry her, if you must, but try not to tear the gown. It was very costly." Sansa tried to run, but Cersei's handmaid caught her before she'd gone a yard. Sir Meron Trant gave her a look that made her cringe, but Kettleblack touched her almost gently and said, "Do as you're told, sweetling. It won't be so bad. Wolves are supposed to be brave, aren't they?" "Brave?" Sansa took a deep breath. "I am a Stark, yes, I can be brave." They were all looking at her, the way they had looked at her that day in the yard when Sir Boris Blunt had torn her clothes off. It had been the imp who saved her from a beating that day, the same man who was waiting for her now. "He's not so bad as the rest of them," she told herself. "I'll go." Cersei smiled. "I knew you would." Afterwards she could not remember leaving the room or descending the steps or crossing the yard. It seemed to take all her attention just to put one foot down in front of the other. Sir Meron and Sir Osmond walked beside her, in cloaks as pale as her own, lacking only the pearls and the direwolf that had been her father's. Joffrey himself was waiting for her on the steps of the castle sept. The king was resplendent, in crimson and gold, his crown on his head. "I'm your father today," he announced. "You're not," she flared. "You'll never be." His face darkened. "I am. I'm your father, and I can marry you to whoever I like, to anyone. You'll marry the pig boy, if I say so, and bed down with him in the sty." His green eyes glittered with amusement. "Or maybe I should give you to Ilion Payne. Would you like him better?" Her heart lurched. "Please, your grace," she begged, "if you ever love me, even a little bit, don't make me marry your... uncle?" Tyrion Lannister stepped through the doors of the sept. "Your grace," he said to Joffrey, "grant me a moment alone with Lady Sansa, if you would be so kind." The king was about to refuse, but his mother gave him a sharp look. They drew off a few feet. Tyrion wore a doublet of black velvet covered with golden scrollwork, thigh-high boots that added 3 inches to his height, a chain of rubies and lion's heads. But the gash across his face was raw and red, and his nose was a hideous scab. "You are very beautiful, Sansa," he told her. "It is good of you to say so, my lord." She did not know what else to say. "Should I tell him he is handsome? He'll think me a fool or a liar." She lowered her gaze and held her tongue. "My lady, this is no way to bring you to your wedding. I'm sorry for that, and for making this so sudden and so secret. My lord father felt it necessary for reasons of state, else I would have come to you sooner as I wished." He waddled closer. "You did not ask for this marriage, I know, no more than I did. If I had refused you, however, they would have wed you to my cousin, Lancel. Perhaps you would prefer that. He is nearer your age and fairer to look upon. If that is your wish, say so, and I will end this farce." "I don't want any Lannister," she wanted to say. "I want Willis. I want Highgarden, and the puppies, and the barge, and sons named Eddard, and Bran, and Rickon." But then she remembered what Dontus had told her in the Godswood. "Tyrell or Lannister, it makes no matter.
It's not me they want, only my claim. You are kind, my lord, she said, defeated. I am a ward of the throne, and my duty is to marry as the king commands. He studied her with his mismatched eyes. I know I'm not the sort of husband young girls dream of, Sansa, he said softly, but neither am I Joffrey. No, she said. You were kind to me, I remember. Tyrion offered her a thick, blunt-fingered hand. Come then, let us do our duty. So she put her hand in his, and he led her to the marriage altar, where the septon waited between the mother and the father to join their lives together. She saw Dantus in his fool's motley, looking at her with big round eyes. Sir Balon Swan and Sir Boris Blunt were there in Kingsguard White, but not Sir Loras. None of the Tyrells are here, she realized suddenly. But there were other witnesses aplenty. The eunuch Varys, Sir Adam Marbrant, Lord Philip Foote, Sir Bronn, Jalabar Zo, a dozen others. Lord Giles was coughing. Lady Ermisande was at the breast, and Lady Tanda's pregnant daughter was sobbing for no apparent reason. Let her sob, Sansa thought. Perhaps I shall do the same before this day is done. The ceremony passed as in a dream. Sansa did all that was required of her. There were prayers and vows and singing, and tall candles burning, 100 dancing lights that the tears in her eyes transformed into 1,000. Thankfully, no one seemed to notice that she was crying as she stood there, wrapped in her father's colours, or if they did, they pretended not to. In what seemed no time at all, they came to the changing of the cloaks. As father of the realm, Joffrey took the place of Lord Eddard Stark. Sansa stood stiff as a lance as his hands came over her shoulders to fumble with the clasp of her cloak. One of them brushed her breast and lingered to give it a little squeeze. Then the clasp opened, and Joff swept her maiden's cloak away with a kingly flourish and a grin. His uncle's part went less well. The bride's cloak, he held, was huge and heavy, crimson velvet richly worked with lions and bordered with gold, satin, and rubies. No one had thought to bring a stool, however, and Tyrion stood a foot and a half shorter than his bride. As he moved behind her, Sansa felt a sharp tug on her skirt. "He wants me to kneel," she realized, blushing. She was mortified. It was not supposed to be this way. She had dreamed of her wedding 1,000 times, and always she had pictured how her betrothed would stand behind her, tall and strong, sweep the cloak of his protection over her shoulders, and tenderly kiss her cheek as he leaned forward to fasten the clasp. She felt another tug at her skirt, more insistent. I won't. Why should I spare his feelings when no one cares about mine? The dwarf tugged at her a third time. Stubbornly, she pressed her lips together and pretended not to notice. Someone behind them tittered. The queen, she thought, but it didn't matter. They were all laughing by then, Joffrey the loudest.
Dantos, down on your hands and knees, the king commanded. My uncle needs a boost to climb his bride.
And so it was that her lord husband cloaked her in the colours of House Lannister while standing on the back of a fool. When Sansa turned, the little man was gazing up at her, his mouth tight, his face as red as her cloak. Suddenly, she was ashamed of her stubbornness. She smoothed her skirts and knelt in front of him. So their heads were on the same level. With this kiss, I pledge my love and take you for my lord and husband. With this kiss, I pledge my love, the dwarf replied hoarsely, and take you for my lady and wife. He leaned forward, and their lips touched briefly. He is so ugly, Sansa thought when his face was close to hers. He is even uglier than the hound. The septon raised his crystal high, so the rainbow light fell down upon them. Here in the sight of gods and men, he said, I do solemnly proclaim a Tyrion of House Lannister and Sansa of House Stark to be man and wife, one flesh, one heart, one soul,
now and forever, and cursed be the one who comes between them. She had to bite her lip to keep from sobbing. The wedding feast was held in the small hall. There were perhaps 50 guests. Lannister retainers and allies, for the most part, joining those who had been at the wedding. And here Sansa found the Tyrells. Margaery gave her such a sad look, and when the Queen of Thorns tottered in between left and right, she never looked at her at all. Eleanor, Arla, and Megha seemed determined not to know her. "My friends," Sansa thought bitterly. Her husband drank heavily and ate but little. He listened whenever someone rose to make a toast, and sometimes nodded a curt acknowledgement, but otherwise his face might have been made of stone. The feast seemed to go on forever, though Sansa tasted none of the food. She wanted it to be done, and yet she dreaded its end. For after the feast would come the bedding. The men would carry her up to her wedding bed, undressing her on the way, and making rude jokes about the fate that awaited her between the sheets, while the women did Tyrion the same honours. Only after they had been bundled naked into bed would they be left alone, and even then the guests would stand outside the bridal chamber, shouting ribald suggestions through the door. The bedding had seemed wonderfully wicked and exciting when Sansa was a girl, but now that the moment was upon her, she felt only dread. She did not think she could bear for them to rip off her clothes, and she was certain she would burst into tears at the first randy jape. When the musicians began to play, she timidly laid her hand on Tyrion's and said, "My lord, should we lead the dance?" His mouth twisted. "I think we've already given them sufficient amusement for one day, don't you?" "As you say, my lord." She pulled her hand back. Joffrey and Margaery led in their place. How can a monster dance so beautifully? Sansa wondered. She had often daydreamed of how she would dance at her wedding, with every eye upon her and her handsome lord. In her dreams they had all been smiling. "Not even my husband is smiling." Other guests soon joined the king and his betrothed on the floor. Eleanor danced with her young squire, and Megha with Prince Tommen. Lady Merryweather, the Moorish beauty with the black hair and the big dark eyes, spun so provocatively that every man in the hall was soon watching her. Lord and Lady Tyrell moved more sedately. Sir Kevin Lannister begged the honour of Lady Jenna Fossaway, Lord Tyrell's sister. Mary Crane took the floor with the exiled Prince Jalabar Zo, gorgeous in his feathered finery. Cersei Lannister partnered first Lord Redwine, then Lord Rowan, and finally her own father, who danced with smooth, unsmiling grace. Sansa sat with her hands in her lap, watching how the queen moved and laughed and tossed her blonde curls. "She charms them all," she thought dully. "How I hate her." She looked away to where Moonboy danced with Dontus.
"Lady Sansa."
Sir Garland Tyrell stood beside the dais.
"Would you honour me, if your lord consents?"
The imp's mismatched eyes narrowed.
"My lady can dance with whomever she pleases."
Perhaps she ought to remain beside her husband, but she wanted to dance so badly. And Sir Garland was brother to Margaery, to Willis, to her Knight of Flowers. "I see why they name you Garland the Glancer," she said, as she took his hand.
"My lady is gracious to say so. My brother Willis gave me that name, as it happens, to protect me."
"To protect you?" She gave him a puzzled look. Sir Garland laughed.
I was a plump little boy, I fear, and we do have an uncle called Garth the Gross. So Willis struck first, though not before threatening me with Garland the Green Sick, Garland the Galling, and Garland the Gargoyle."
It was so sweet and silly that Sansa had to laugh, despite everything. Afterward, she was absurdly grateful. Somehow, the laughter made her hopeful again, if only for a little while. Smiling, she let the music take her, losing herself in the steps, in the sound of flute and pipes and harp, in the rhythm of the drum,
and from time to time in Sir Garland's arms, when the dance brought them together. "My lady wife is most concerned for you," he said quietly one such time. "Lady Leonette is too sweet. Tell her I'm well." "A bride at her wedding should be more than well." His voice was not unkind. "You seemed close to tears."
"Tears of joy, sir."
"Your eyes give the lie to your tongue." Sir Garland turned her, drew her close to his side. "My lady, I have seen how you look at my brother. Loris is valiant and handsome, and we all love him dearly. But your imp will make a better husband. He is a bigger man than he seems, I think."
The music spun them apart before Sansa could think of a reply. It was Mace Tyrell opposite her, red-faced and sweaty, then Lord Merryweather, then Prince Tommen.
"I want to be married too," said the
plump little princeling, who was all of 9.
"I'm taller than my uncle."
"I know you are," said Sansa, before the partners changed again. Sir Kevin told her she was beautiful. Jalabar Zur said something she did not understand in the summer tongue, and Lord Redwine wished her many fat children and long years of joy. And then the dance brought her face to face with Joffrey. Sansa stiffened as his hand touched hers, but the king tightened his grip and drew her closer.
"You shouldn't look so sad. My uncle is an ugly little thing, but you'll still have me."
"You're to marry Marjorie."
"A king can have other women. Whores. My father did. One of the Aegons did too. The third one, or the fourth. He had lots of whores and lots of bastards."
As they whirled to the music, Joff gave her a moist kiss.
"My uncle will bring you to my bed whenever I command it."
Sansa shook her head. "He won't."
"He will, or I'll have his head. That King Aegon, he had any woman he wanted, whether they were married or no."
Thankfully, it was time to change again. Her legs had turned to wood, though, and Lord Rowan, Sir Tallard, and Eleanor Squire all must have thought her a very clumsy dancer. And then she was back with Sir Garland once more, and soon, blessedly, the dance was over. Her relief was short-lived. No sooner had the music died than she heard Joffrey say,
"It's time to bed them. Let's get the clothes off her, eh? And have a look at what the she-wolf's got to give my uncle."
Other men took up the cry loudly. Her dwarf husband lifted his eyes slowly from his wine cup.
"I'll have no bedding."
Joffrey seized Sansa's arm.
"You will, if I command it."
The imp slammed his dagger down in the table, where it stood quivering.
"Then you'll service your own bride with a wooden prick. I'll geld you, I swear it."
A shock silence fell. Sansa pulled away from Joffrey, but he had a grip on her, and her sleeve ripped. No one even seemed to hear. Queen Cersei turned to her father. "Did you hear him?" Lord Tywin rose from his seat.
"I believe we can dispense with the bedding. Tyrion, I am certain you did not mean to threaten the king's royal person."
Sansa saw a spasm of rage pass across her husband's face.
"I misspoke," he said. "It was a bad jape, sire."
"You threatened to gel me,"
Joffrey said shrilly.
"I did, your grace," said Tyrion, "but only because I envied your royal manhood. Mine own is so small and stunted."
His face twisted into a leer.
"And if you take my tongue, you will leave me nowhere at all to pleasure this sweet wife you gave me."
Laughter burst from the lips of Sir Osmond Kettleback. Someone else sniggered, but Joff did not laugh, nor Lord Tywin.
"Your grace," he said, "my son is drunk. You can see that."
"I am," the imp confessed, "but not so drunk that I cannot attend to my own bedding."
He hopped down from the dais and grabbed Sansa roughly.
"Come, wife, time to smash your portcullis. I want to play Come Into the Castle."
Red-faced Sansa went with him from the small hall. "What choice do I have?" Tyrion waddled when he walked, especially when he walked as quickly as he did now. The guards were merciful. and neither Joffrey nor any of the others moved to follow. For their wedding night they had been granted the use of an airy bedchamber high in the Tower of the Hand. Tyrion kicked the door shut behind them. "There is a flagon of good Arbor gold on the sideboard, Sansa. Will you be so kind as to pour me a cup?" "Is that wise, my lord?" "Nothing was ever wiser. I am not truly drunk, you see, but I mean to be." Sansa filled a goblet for each of them. "It will be easier if I am drunk as well." She sat on the edge of the great curtained bed and drained half her cup in three long swallows. No doubt it was a very fine wine, but she was too nervous to taste it. It made her head swim. "Would you have me undress, my lord?" "Tyrion," he cocked his head. "My name is Tyrion, Sansa." "Tyrion, my lord, should I take off my gown, or do you want to undress me?" She took another swallow of wine. The imp turned away from her. "The first time I wed, there was us and a drunken septon and some pigs to bear witness. We ate one of our witnesses at our wedding feast. Tysha fed me crackling, and I licked the grease off her fingers, and we were laughing when we fell into bed." "You were wed before. I had forgotten." "You did not forget. You never knew." "Who was she, my lord?" Sansa was curious, despite herself. "Lady Tysha," his mouth twisted, "of House Silverfist. Their arms have one gold coin and 100 silver upon a bloody sheet. Ours was a very short marriage, as befits a very short man, I suppose." Sansa stared down at her hands and said nothing. "How old are you, Sansa?" asked Tyrion after a moment. 13, she said, "when the moon turns." "Gods have mercy." The dwarf took another swallow of wine. "Well, talk won't make you older. Shall we get on with this, my lady, if it please you?" "It will please me to please my lord husband." That seemed to anger him. "You hide behind courtesy as if it were a castle wall." "Courtesy is a lady's armor," Sansa said. Her scepter had always told her that. "I am your husband. You can take off your armor now." "And my clothing?" "That too." He waved his wine cup at her. "My lord father has commanded me to consummate this marriage." Her hands trembled as she began fumbling at her clothes. She had 10 thumbs instead of fingers, and all of them were broken. Yet somehow she managed the laces and buttons, and her cloak and gown and girdle and undersilk slid to the floor until finally she was stepping out of her small clothes. Goose prickles covered her arms and legs. She kept her eyes on the floor, too shy to look at him, but when she was done, she glanced up and found him staring. There was hunger in his green eye, it seemed to her, and fury in the black. Sansa did not know which scared her more. "You're a child," he said. She covered her breasts with her hands. "I flowered." "A child," he repeated. "But I want you. Does that frighten you, Sansa?"
"Yes."
"Me as well. I know I'm ugly."
"No, my lord."
He pushed himself to his feet. "Don't lie, Sansa. I am malformed, scarred, and small, but—" she could see him groping— "a bed, when the candles are blown out. I am made no worse than other men. In the dark, I am the Knight of Flowers." He took a draught of wine. "I am generous, loyal to those who are loyal to me. I've proven I'm no craven, and I am cleverer than most. Surely wits count for something. I can even be kind. Kindness is not a habit with us Lannisters, I fear. But I know I have some, somewhere. I could be good to you." "He is as frightened as I am," Sansa realized. Perhaps that should have made her feel more kindly toward him, but it did not. All she felt was pity, and pity was death to desire. He was looking at her, waiting for her to say something, but all her words had withered. She could only stand there trembling. When he finally realized that she had no answer for him, Tyrion Lannister drained the last of his wine.
"I understand," he said bitterly. "Get into the bed, Sansa. We need to do our duty."
She climbed onto the feather bed, conscious of his stare. A scented beeswax candle burned on the bedside table, and rose petals had been strewn between the sheets. She had started to pull up a blanket to cover herself when she heard him say, "No." The cold made her shiver, but she obeyed. Her eyes closed, and she waited. After a moment, she heard the sound of her husband pulling off his boots and the rustle of clothing as he undressed himself. When he hopped onto the bed and put his hand on her breast, Sansa could not help but shudder. She lay with her eyes closed, every muscle tense, dreading what might come next. Would he touch her again? Kiss her? Should she open her legs for him now? She did not know what was expected of her. "Sansa!" The hand was gone. "Open your eyes." She had promised to obey. She opened her eyes. He was sitting by her feet, naked. Where his legs joined, his man's staff poked up stiff and hard from a thicket of coarse yellow hair, but it was the only thing about him that was straight. "My lady," Tyrion said, "you are lovely, make no mistake. But I cannot do this. My father be damned. We will wait. The turn of a moon, a year, a season, however long it takes, until you have come to know me better, and perhaps to trust me a little." His smile might have been meant to be reassuring, but without a nose, it only made him look more grotesque and sinister. "Look at him," Sansa told herself. "Look at your husband. At all of him. Septa Mordaunt said all men are beautiful. Find his beauty. Try." She stared at the stunted legs, the swollen, brutish brow, the green eye and the black one, the raw stump of his nose and crooked pink scar, the coarse tangle of black and gold hair that passed for his beard. Even his manhood was ugly, thick and veined, with a bulbous purple head. "This is not right. This is not fair. How have I sinned that the gods would do this to me? How?" "On my honor as a Lannister," the imp said, "I will not touch you until you want me to." It took all the courage that was in her to look in those mismatched eyes and say, "And if I never want you to, my lord?" His mouth jerked, as if she had slapped him. "Never?" Her neck was so tight, she could scarcely nod. "Why," he said, "that is why the gods made whores for imps like me." He closed his short, blunt fingers into a fist and climbed down off the bed.
Catelyn. Sir Desmond Grell had served House Tully all his life. He'd been a squire when Catelyn was born, a knight when she learned to walk and ride and swim, master at arms by the day she was wed. He had seen Lord Huster's little cat become a young woman, a great lord's lady, mother to a king. And now he has seen me become a traitor as well. Her brother Edmure had named Sir Desmond Castellan of River Run when he rode off to battle, so it fell to him to deal with her crime. To ease his discomfort, he brought her father's steward with him, Dor Uthereyd Swain. The two men stood and looked at her. Sir Desmond, stout, red-faced, embarrassed, Uthereyd, grave, gaunt, melancholy. Each waited for the other to speak. "They have given their lives to my father's service, and I have repaid them with disgrace," Catelyn thought wearily. "Are your sons," Sir Desmond said at last. "Maester Wyman told us, the poor lads, terrible, terrible. But—" "We share your grief, my lady," said Uthereyd Swain. "All Riverrun mourns with you, but—" "The news must have driven you mad," Sir Desmond broke in. "A madness of grief, a mother's madness.
Men will understand. You did not know.
I did,
Catelyn said firmly.